tongue. But I'm not a magician, linguistic magician like Marco, who can flip from one language to the other. And I'd like to really begin by thanking the organizers, since I'm, well, Ruth follows me, but I guess I'm the last official paper. For just a wonderful conference. I learned enormous amounts from this, and I've never been at a conference where there was better interaction between historians and literary people and musicologists, so it's just fantastic. I'd also like to thank the organizers for putting me last, because my paper, you may have noticed, is a little bit exalted. My approach is a little bit, I think of myself as sort of in the stratosphere, and sort of the satellite which is sending the signals to the mobile phones, and looking at the phenomenon of troubadour composition from a great distance, like longue history, where I'm trying to see the patterns of networks, one on top of the other, that are actually perhaps capable of explaining troubadour composition. Part of that is because I like that point of view. Part of it is because I very much like to mix up the distinction between medieval and modern. So I like to think of us as medieval and them as modern, for example. And I think that that's why you will have seen me referring quite a bit to Bruno Latour in this paper, because I saw once in France his book, Nous n'avons jamais été modernes, which I loved the title so much that I bought it instantly, and I really did enjoy it, and I think that's a very profound statement. We have absolutely never been modern. I think we are still, in many senses, medieval. So let's just begin, and I'll have lots of citations, which some of them I'll read, and some of it, if we're running out of time, I won't. So this paper was inspired by what some have called the spatial turn in literary studies, and what others have called network theory. In other words, it looks beyond space, and Christian's paper the other day was particularly good at this, talking about the difference between space, place, and community. So Ventadour, we saw this wild, he told us about how distant it is from everything. That's space. So I've got here that space looks beyond the open, less defined regions over which it is sometimes difficult to exert control, to place, which would be the Castro of Ventadour, a finite space that is categorized, bounded, and capable of being named. And then within that, move to the collectives and identities that are realized through chains of exchange within and between places. And that would be the instantiation of a court, of a mentality of a court, and finally the mentality of an individual subject. So what I'm aiming at here is a reconstruction of literary cartography, a connecting up of the dots that can tell us who was where, doing what, at a particular moment, and why we still know about that. Gilda Caiti Russo's wonderful study of the Malaspina courts from 2005 was an inspiration to me when I read that book as well in thinking about these questions, and particularly her closing sentence, La littérature est aussi l'histoire de la destination du message qui seul peut fournir la clé pour le déchiffrer. Her insight and the decision she made to open just a single set of contained places and the poets and songs that moved between them was a revelation, as was Martine Aurel's work on politics and the troubadours from that same period, and finally the invaluable collection of some 158 extant tensus edited by Linda Patterson and Ruth Harvey in 2010. All of these scholars brought to their topics a new viewpoint, sometimes anthropological, sometimes geographical, to which I would like to add today something more speculative and a slightly theoretical angle. I will not have time to discuss this fully, but I'm interested in how troubadour courts and the travel and communication that connected them was part of a larger network, a Mediterranean network, and how history and fiction worked hand in hand in fleshing out that network and inscribing it in the form of literary objects. In a recent book, first of all, the books that I've just mentioned that were so helpful to me, Ingrid Nelson, completely different topic, made a statement that I thought was very pertinent for the troubadours as well as for the Anglo-Saxon poets that she's talking about. She talks about the Anglo-Saxon poets having performed tactical interventions in their writing, ad hoc and improvisatory, often involving unauthorized hybridization, recombination, or merging of discrete forms of categories. Nelson's referring here to Michel de Certeau, a thinker whose studies on how we mark space and are marked by space led to a veritable space industry in literary studies in the past two decades. To his foundational insights, I want to add those of Bruno Latour, a theorist who upended many of the commonplaces of social theory since the 1970s by privileging the triumvirate of place, object, and interconnection over that of inspiration and individual agency. So the object, in essence, rather than the inspiration for it. Following on from his earlier work in network theory, which is usually called ANT, A-N-T, we can envisage the troubadours as actants in a system, embodied in a network, pieces on a game board or playing field, translators, in essence, whose contributions to a kinetic tapestry larger than themselves actually made things happen. The places I'll be referring to today, and the choices are more or less arbitrary, based largely on having read Jeeva's book and Ruth and Linda's edition, are the Lunigiana Piemonte region of northern Italy, north of Genoa and across the Alps from Gap, and Alp, the famous but loosely defined port of Blackats in the foothills of the Alps. And I've chosen these sites simply by virtue of the songs that mention them or their patrons. And I'll look at quite a few of these songs, actually, in some way this afternoon. And all of them, all of these regions were in some ways in flux, that is, in a permanent state of change. The Lunigiana region was key to the propagation of troubadour song in the early 13th century as the poets moved east and addressed new audiences. And there's so many insights that I've learned from that I could add to this, but we won't have time. I would thank everybody for the things I've learned from each, for example. It included parts of what are now the Piemonte, Liguria, and even Toscana and Emilia-Romagna, and its importance is partly to be explained by the omnipresent political tensions over the rivaling claims from the Malaspina, Monferrato, and Genoese rulers. This was further exacerbated, of course, by the conflict between the Guelphs and Ghibellines, and the rise and fall of the Emperor Frederick II, and its own geographical position as a crossroad, a node in a larger network in which those seeking commercial, military, or intellectual fortune on either side of the Alps had to pass. Blackats of Pau, like so many other poets and minor or impoverished nobles, spent a wild youth roaming the lands ruled by Alfonso I and II, and only on the death of his father, Blackats Sr., did he settle into his inheritance and offer his services to the Count of Provence, avid as ever to extend his influence throughout this region. From a young chevalier brigand, as Aurel characterized him, he would soon become a supporter of law, order, and centralized administration at the court of Raymond V of Berenguer of Aix. His own court in Alp was immortalized, of course, in the songs of Sordello, but it's less clear just what that court fostered and the part that it played outside the sphere of Raymond's influence. So using terms borrowed from Bruno Latour, I'm going to argue that all of these figures, these traveling poets and patrons alike, especially patrons such as Guillaume de Malaspina and Blackats, resemble what Michel Serres, the philosopher, anthropologist, whatever he calls himself, what he called parasites. Activators who keep connections moving and active, who produced noise, that's one of his major things of what a parasite does, it produces noise or irritation in the system. Produced noise in the form of politically charged tensus and partimenti, and who charted history as a series of objects given and exchanged between places. They translated this experience for the future, these patrons and poets, into a series of musical and verbal portraits in which political tensions are expressed in vivid and challenging language that keeps that system moving and produces something that Yves Citon, who's at the University of Grenoble right now, would call littérature, and I'm citing him. There is literature as soon as an agent attempts to reformulate a new concatenation of letters, words, and sentences in order to meet a shared thirst to account for a yet inexpressible nuance in our modes of existence. Now, before I try to unpack that no-way statement and attempt to read our traveling poets in these terms, let's look more closely at what Latour has had to say about these modes d'existence, or modes of existence, and what Yves Citon, in turn, whom I think is one of his best commentators, makes of them. Actor network theory, or ANT, though by now supplanted by the revisionary stance of Latour's new system, which is M, an inquiry into modes of existence, okay, an enquête on modes d'existence, remains, in my view, a particularly appropriate tool for the discussion of the troubadours, not only because it cuts through the reverence with which they are usually read, that is, a complete reverence about the beauty, for example, and the rhetoric, etc. A little bit like the troubadour songs that I like myself, which are slightly off-kilter, and I particularly have taste for the political, as we see in this paper, the political and gnarly side of the troubadours. The epistemological shake-up that Latour's ANT set off in the social sciences in the 1980s was, among other things, a direct reaction to the explosive events in the European continent from 1936 or earlier as well, through 1962, and of course we can say until 2017, and a proto-postmodern rejection of master narratives. Those events, in both the historical sense and the more theoretical slant, given the word of event, in the words of Alain Badiou, for example, led to a complete destabilization of French intellectual art, whose effects can still be observed in political and literary circles today. Michel Serres, again, this eminent philosopher of science and teacher of René Latour, which of course explains the connection between Latour and Serres, had this to say of those years when asked by Latour to chart his intellectual growth. This is the Enquête sur les modes d'existence that I was just mentioning. René Latour did a series of interviews of Michel Serres, which were published in a book called Éclaircissement. And when asked about how he became who he was, who is, Michel Serres said, "Cela tient à ces années noires. On y étouffait parmi un air irrespirable de malheur, de violence et de crime, de défaite et d'humiliation, de culpabilité. Jamais sans doute l'humanité occidentale, si avancée dans ses réalisations scientifiques et culturelles, n'était allée si loin dans l'abomination. Cette ambiance tragique a commencé, croyez-le, j'ai sur ce point bonne mémoire, quelque chose en moi n'a jamais quitté ces temps-là, en 36, à la guerre d'Espagne, par inexprimables horreurs, et s'est dénoué par les règlements de compte sanglants de la libération en 45. Les guerres coloniales et quelques affaires de torture ont achevé cette époque vers les années 60. Au total, un bon quart de siècle, ma génération se forme charnellement dans cet atroce environnement et se tient depuis lors éloignée de toute politique. Le pouvoir ne signifie encore pour elle que cadavre et supplice." Serres goes on to detail how the trauma of his youth encouraged him to reject the instruction that he had received at the École Normale Supérieure and elsewhere, the École du Nîmes, for example, and to look to other options, discourses, or modes of accessing truth. When René Latour, attempting to mediate or moderate somewhat Serres' statements during one of these interviews, asks if there's any way to reach a synthesis between the shifts and the craters and the fluctuations that the master is alluding to, Serres cautions him not to domesticate the seriousness of these cuts and ruptures, saying, "Networks are fine. They leave an image that is almost too stable. But if you immerse the network in time, the network itself is going to fluctuate." I think I have this up here. Yeah, it is going to fluctuate, becoming very unstable and bifurcate endlessly. Serres' warning was apt. History is almost absent from René Latour's analyses, but his latest project attempts to address that lapsus by synthesizing history and fiction as one of his modes of existence. So these modes of existence, I think there are 16 of them which all have a sort of title like fiction, history, fall into that category. To return to his teacher then, in his foundational work, Serre wrote Le Parasite. He presented his thought through a series of parables and explications of text, a mode of philosophical discourse that more closely resembles what Yves Citon claims to find most promising in Bruno Latour's thought. In Citon's words, Latour's project establishes that the arts matter through their mattering, that is, through their power to give actual existence to relations whose relata are still to emerge in our shared reality. One could say that the an inquiry into modes of existence, project is itself deeply literary, insofar as its dynamics rely on a recursive loop whereby we care about something and for something because it matters to us, while at the same time it matters to us because we care about it. Having drawn some attention to the imbrication of Ant with its own socio-political past, as well as Michel Serre's pinpointing of the essential inclusion of time and history and messiness in any mapping or analysis of phenomena, I want only to add that both men seem to agree that new discourses will always and inevitably emerge from cataclysm, from the clear perception that one world has now ended and another world has now begun. The epistemological implications of that belief can also be detected, I believe, in those troubadours acted in the Lunigiana and the courts of Provence in those first decades of the 13th century. It was in those years that poets who had fled their origins and flung off earlier identities began to imagine themselves as part of and privileged witnesses to a new and emerging network, an outgrowth of the Crusades, of course, and still changing political alliances, but especially as an effect of the Albigensian Crusade and soon after the French Angevins in the Mediterranean sphere. Though one could argue that most of the tensions surging through the troubadour network in the early 13th century were simply a matter of money, property, influence, alliance, and vendetta, which is certainly the case, darker issues reflecting changing political realities were almost always at the heart of those conflicts. The wars between Aragon and Toulouse being fought along the Durance, the incursion of the French forces throughout Provence, the changing fortunes of the local lords, whose loyalties were often unpredictable and changeable, the poets and patrons taking up responsible positions within administrations or courts where one might have never predicted their allegiance just a decade or so earlier. The fates of Blacas and Sordello present a striking case of what I've just outlined. A move toward X and the influence of Aragon in the case of Blacas, not all at all predictable during his wild and woolly youth, and the permanent move on the part of Sordello and Bertrand d'Alamanon to ally with Charles d'Anjou. The tenso between Albert Marquez and Ramon de Vaqueras from 1189 sets out clearly some of these thinly veiled thinly veiled resentments that festered among and between the Montferrat and the Malaspina families, again, this is thanks to Gilda that I'm saying all of them, and which were reflected in the rapidly changing conditions under which poets were composing. Albert Marquez, Verses Pierre Mala, it's true that I have loved the deceitful woman who is the subject of your challenge. You can read the Occitania, so I'll just read a quicker translation. And who has abandoned me and good reputation. But I can do nothing about it, for I have committed no fault against her, but rather served and honored her for a long time. But I hope you and she will be punished for the fate you have broken 100 times, and for the sake of wealth, which is why the Genoese complained about you, for you imposed a toll on their family and their detriment. Albert counters, of course, that Raibaut is every bit as opportunistic as he is, feigning poverty and prowess to garner riches and greater fame. The world being portrayed here is one of posing and pretense, in which the most convincing performance wins, and others of the Tensos and Partimin echo the precarious position of the patron in more subtle but still ominous terms. Amérique de Péguillon, who was spoken this morning, for example, challenges David and Coy to choose between Hoc in null. Which is the better answer? Dopere licet hoc as the more obvious choice. I think this is, yeah. Laberic hoc son veor, perque vos creces ac salusas, etc. Aimeric upholds the wisdom of no, saying that yes leads to deception. The unthinking answer of the barros malvats, who promise much but deliver little. No has the admittedly meager merit of at least being honest. In the final Pobla and Tornada, Pere heads off to see Nugo del Baus, while Aymeric refrains from associating his chosen patron, Blacas, with No. Rather, they send by the matter on to Blacas for judgment, both agreeing that he is frank and enseignats, a tactic that we might call wheedling by flattery. A similar tact is taken by Aymeric in Psalm 10:3, 16:3, another partimen, thanks to Ruth, I've got this, in which Aymeric and Albertet rehearse their loyalty or lack of it in relation to a lover who is torn between two ladies. One who gives him everything, provided that he leaves his other lover, and the second lover who gives him nothing, but whom he actually loves twice as much. This is another thinly veiled allegory, it seems to me, about patronage and court ambiance. This song that champions the long-suffering lover who never sways in his affections. Albert claims to be the perfect, naive lover who stays true to his devotion, regardless of reward. I, as a true lover, determined to love sincerely, perform whom my heart never from whom my heart has never strayed, for I have no desire to accept any illicit reward. On the contrary, I wish to serve my lady until I may obtain love's precious joy. But Aymeric answers like a man who knows his network, and he has learned how to place his bets. You've got that on the second side here. Nalbert, I am convinced that those who have knowledge and understanding of the matter will consider yours to be the worst side of the argument. I am sure it is more fitting for a man with only a half love to be happy in kissing and making love than to have a whole love and just to sigh and dream. I set more store by a fruit that I can reach with my own hands than one hanging so high that I'm obliged to throw things at it. So how does one survive in this world when the audience for poetry is so changing and fickle and their identity is prone to also to rapid change or dramatic dissolution? As Aymeric points out in his song 10.6, here we go, 16.5, Tenso Sorel, that what the eye tells you is not necessarily true. I tell you, therefore, that people can see a nothing. For if you look at a river from a high bridge, your eyes will tell you that you are still moving and that the running water is motionless. Aymeric here is playing games a la Arnaud Daniel. Appearances are deceiving, but don't be deceived. A good troubadour knows that he has to be whatever is required for any given occasion. He must be circumstantial and performative, just like his public. Both conjure themselves out of a conjoining of words and music. And in the balance between the one and the other hangs the fate of the song and the poet. In such a world, troubadour songs play the role of mediators. They incite interest and antagonism, connect and divide fragile communities, what Citon referred to as our social meshwork. A performance can call forth relations at the very moment of its connection to the audience, and those relations are then layered one upon the other, especially in the poetic dialogues, empowered by their theatricalization. Objects, and by objects I mean listeners, the audience, communities, songs, and the relations that keep those more conjoined, are mutually constituted in this competitive world of praise and contumely, no less real than the supposed reality that surrounds them. And amour becomes one of the keys to this process of constructing and deconstructing community. Amour, and by that, of course, I mean a signifier that has a connection within the structure of the song, that plays a role in the verbal construction of the song, rather than as an indicator of personal emotion or erotic interest. As a signifier, it serves as the focus, the point de repère around which the collective forms, what Michel Serres would call a quasi-object. Its presence enables an instant type of communication in which each actant, or subject, is accorded a part to play with the ephemeral public, and become that ephemeral public becomes, for that moment, a community. As again, Citon says in his reading of Michel, Bruno Latour, fiction, one of the modes d'existence, one of the codes that Latour has invented, it takes here the form of allegorical love songs. And they make us feel attached for that moment. They instill, citing Citon here, they instill or awaken the still hollow forms of what will soon start to matter. It's hardly surprising that some of the material I've cited was almost certainly composed in and around the Malaspina courts along the Via Francigena, one of what Gilda has called the axes of communication and commerce at the crossing of routes leading to Lombardia, Toscana, and Liguria. Gilda, again, sees three distinct periods within the golden age of Malaspina influence. The first, from 1182 to 1205, was chronicled by Rambaldo Lajeras alone and consists of just five songs. The second period, from 1212 to 1220, comprises the last years of Guillaume de Malaspina and the heyday or Malacaso, one of the particular site that is mentioned quite a bit. And then a final third and later period dates from the death of Hugues de Saint-Cyr, who was mentioned again this morning, in 1253, stretching then to the end of the century when the songs are marked by a more biting political tone. It's the second of these periods, the 1212 to 1220 for the moment, I'm going to be talking about, because it proved the most fruitful, at least from the point of view of contemporary collectors who were then compiling, or were to compile, you know, half a decade later, the Italian manuscripts, and includes some 27 to 28 songs which mention explicitly the Malaspina family in one form or another. This is the period in which Oramala Castle became a true center for troubadour composition, another node within a wider network, or what Jonathan Lamb called in another context, the zone of the quasi-object. By 1220, the castle had been abandoned definitively by Corrado de Malaspina, and the focus of troubadour song in Italy crept ever closer thereafter to the Veneto. Gilda calls the Malaspina corpus from this region a tradition in conversation with itself. And on that point, I think she's absolutely right. But it's important to take that statement back a step to examine who or what that self is, and to whom these songs are actually addressed. Yes, this is still a courtly milieu, recycling tropes from the previous century, but those tropes now are more personalized, more particularized, more barbed, and more dangerous than before. This milieu and these songs that emanate from this milieu form a distinct corpus and propagate a form of in amours that would serve, again in Gilda's words, as the socioeconomic cement of European feudal aristocracy for centuries to come. In such an environment, the concept of amour, acting as a binding agent, and in a larger sense as a metaphorical game board on which the troubadours operate. As N. Peyre says in another, thinly veiled partiment with Albertet at the court of Oramala, Albertet el cor de taller vos deraimat, so I shall have you in checkmate for the suitor who over a long period is an upholder of worth and liberality and generosity is 100 times more estimable than the man who in the short term brings his affairs to ruin. Once people get nothing from him, then, even though he is a nobleman, it will be of no use to him. And how will it be if he has not the wherewithal to be liberal or generous? The troubadour's role in this game is to keep things moving, as I said, keep the givers giving. And in this sense, amour plays the part of a pretext, a condition without which nothing will happen, but which has only value when it's in play. So Michel Serres' notion of the quasi-object resembles this artifact, which holds our attention only when it operates as the instigator or stand-in for collective energy. Think of the football in the center of the field, which focuses all the eyes and the action of the players, or the chess piece on which the action hangs, or the rabbit tail around the racetrack that keeps the greyhounds running. When in motion, we cannot keep our eyes off these quasi-objects, but when inert, not the focus of attention, as Serre says, they might as well be dead. Serre calls a ball over there on the ground, nothing. It is stupid, it has no meaning, function, or value. But when we play with that ball, on the other hand, we are for that ball, so we become an adjunct to the quasi-object. As substance, its ability to arouse our attention and emotion makes of us players, arbiters, betters, fans, or subjects. Latour was borrowing this term from Serre, and he popularized it in his own works on science and epistemology. This is Serre from We Have Never Been Modern. Of quasi-objects, quasi-subjects, we shall simply say that they trace networks like a lure. They are real, quite real, and we humans have not made them, but they are collective because they attach us to one another, because they circulate in our hands and define our social bonds by this very circulation. When Serre first introduced this concept in Le Parasite, it was by reference to a nursery rhyme about a slipper that is passed around a group of children seated in a circle. Ce quasi-objet objet n'est pas un objet, mais il en est un, néanmoins, puisqu'il n'est pas sujet, puisqu'il est dans le monde. Il est aussi un quasi-sujet, puisqu'il marque ou désigne un sujet qui sans lui ne le serait pas. Qui n'est pas découvert le furet dans la main est fondu, anonyme, dans une chaîne monotone où il ne se distingue pas. Il n'est pas un individu, il n'est pas reconnu, découvert, découpé. Il est de la chaîne et dans la chaîne. Il court comme le furet dans le collectif. Ce quasi-objet, en courant, fait du collectif. S'il s'arrête, il fait l'individu. Si celui-ci est découvert, il est mort. Ce qui est sujet, qui ai-je ou que suis-je, le furet mobile tisse le nous, le collectif. Qu'il s'arrête, il marque le je. This quasi-object that marks the subject is also essential to the construction or weaving of interconnectedness or intersubjectivity or a court. Through its presence or intercession, we recognize ourselves as subjects or not, and we can feel when the collective is actually binding or holding. But the we, made up of the subject of the collective, is nothing more than the fluctuating movement back and forth of the I, a token exchanged within the network of passes among the subjects who weave and are woven by the collective. And I've got another long quote, but it basically says what I just said, so let's get that. If we imagine this for just a moment in terms of organizational theory, we can see that the ball or the slipper is anything that keeps the group in movement. Profit, attention, prestige, praise. Stop that movement, and the one who's left holding the sack is dead. Game over, interest faded, the winner is the loser. For as Latour puts it, let us take a quasi-object. The point of departure doesn't count. The only thing that matters is the mingling of attachments that define either the objects or the subjects, like the likes and dislikes, the obligations and attachments, the passions and coldness that they have aroused. In the case of the Malaspina court at Guatemala Castle, we can imagine the troubadour's public as such a mingling of attachments. The players, the seekers, those who have established an interest, those who want to win. What is circulating among them is amour as metonymy, praise for knowing the ways of love and its rewards. Similar in its nothingness and its stupidity to Serre's ball, but riveting when embedded in song, in music. When it lands on you such that you come under its scrutiny, you pass it on quickly, a form of poetic largesse in which the courtly circle keeps spinning, let's say. If you foolishly hold on to it like a child who has failed to understand the rules of the game, you will find yourself out of step, out of the spotlight, of no interest, a dead man who has mistaken amour for a thing. To use another of Serre's examples, like American football, the only one who can be tackled is the one who holds the ball. This quasi-object designates him. He is marked with the sign of the ball. Let him beware. Beware indeed. Let us look back at a couple of songs in the light, I'm just coming to a conclusion here, of what I've been saying. In the first song, that has been variously attributed to Peri Vidal, Peyrol, and Girard Bournet, the poet begins by reproaching those who would find fault. Amour, he says, provides a refuge for the individual within the group. It offers solace to those who suffer, and it makes the unhappy and unlucky amongst us into courtly men. It safeguards those who know how to cherish it and keep it hidden from falling into error. And it procures pardon for those who have failed. It's a big task, right? Through its power, all finamans, or lovers, adhering to the principle of this discourse, are honored and appreciated. The perfect donna, or really patron, I'm suggesting, is the one who gives, but it is the person who gives without having been asked who raises the gift of the status of the gift. A gift that one has to beg for diminishes the return, even when it is given. And these are some of the citations here. The gift and the giver all point to the patron here, but it is clear that the lady and the lover might also, on occasion, embody amour and gain status through that association, though his or her status would depend on who's watching and who's listening. Time enters into this, obviously. Value is not stable, it is negotiated. And the key to winning is to stay in the game. Hold yourself, and I'm citing from the song, en suspense des sons, a state of suspension and receptiveness. Hope and perseverance can save you. We are told in the Tornada that this odd song was sent to Guillem de Malaspina, who is said to maintain his worth and prestige by virtue of his adherence to the game of giving. En vostro un joy desolat edu. In recompense, Peire o Perolo Gerald, whoever it is who wrote this, asserts that he will present him with his song, En suspense son, in hopes of future reward. Lanfranc Cigala's Chandlor, written in the later period of the Malaspina courts, again, this is Gilda's edition, evokes a lady whose centrality defined the court. She is the slipper or the ferret or the rabbit lure, we might say, who kept it all running and whose death has spelt its ruin. Mort est tout ce que le monde era de car et super covalier de morel. Dead is everything that was precious in the world and which made the very least the best. And which made the singer sing, and which made people esteem love of ladies, and which established the value of value, and which made one stand out above the others. Each of us cries now, for it has been 1,000 years since death has acted so unfortunately. Nor are the poets shy about castigating the guilty parties when a disaster happens and the system collapses as a result. Just a few years earlier, Aymeric de Peguillon, for example, minces no words in this denunciation of the court of Guillem Malaspina, which he says has lost its moral compass. If you think back to the earlier citation in which Aymeric claimed to have been happy to eat the fruit at hand, rather than being obliged to throw things as high-hanging and inaccessible prey, he is now well ready, by the time he composed this song, to change his tune. The Malaspina era was now coming to a close, and he had failed to follow his own advice. Rather than play the field, he stayed put. Here we go. He failed to follow his own advice. He stayed put, did not follow the ferret, trusted foolishly that faithlessness would be rewarded, or faithfulness, sorry, would be rewarded. And now, feeling deeply deceived, he resents the newcomers rushing in to take his place. And I think it was Marco who cited this morning. I folli culte il figliol crescent trope, non est belli croi giocaret novel. Crazies and the whores and their offspring are now springing up all around us, and I don't like it one bit. And low class, upstart poets, annoying and ill spoken, are running wild and getting ahead. already the backbiters outnumber us 2-to-1, and there was no one left to show them up for what they really are. Amerik's closing shot is again at the expense of the House of Malaspina, who, it would appear, are it, left holding the bag, just as vulnerable as their subjects. It is they who have lost sight of the ferret, if you were to believe Amerik, Amur, and in doing so, they have lost the game by winning. That is, they refusing the gift and withholding their generosity. Interestingly, the young Sordello, who's come up a lot today, served in this song as the metonym for all troubadour itinerants, who, having lost their patron or backer, as well as their subjectivity, now lose at the gaming table as well. And Aymeric's final warning couldn't be clearer. Now you will see the mob approaching Malaspina and the band of men who hold its flesh and meat. Add to that Raimondo Vaqueras' condemnation of Marquis Albert from several decades earlier, and we can see that the power flows not only from on high to those below, but it circulates from poet to patron as well as patron to poet, ally and foe, with its inscription in literary history, its final victory. Albert Marquez, Tuch Ligere. Here we go. Albert Marquez, all the soldiers are scared and frightened of you, that they all call you the whoring Marquis, disinherited, disloyal, and faithless. Or the visceral denunciation of the poet patron Bertrand d'Alamanon by his juglar Granet, this one here, the Vos Milancourt compaire. Sir Bertrand, I'm making a formal complaint about your tight-fistedness, mate. I've served you, this is Ruth's transition, mate, I love that. I've served you faithfully and it's done me no good. And if you're unwilling to be a bit more open-handed, I'll tell you something about you yourself, which I'm sure will annoy you, for I know a lot about your habits. One final song to bring us back to Provence, the blind and otherwise unknown Joglar Bonafé, taunts Blacats, the best patron ever, if we are to believe the Vida, with his fall from grace. Zenyan Blacats, here we go. Lord Blacats, now that deception falls on you from all sides, and the hermit folk invoke God against you, the wealth that keeps itself well hidden from you is so great that Ayol himself never displayed greater pomp here. Enemies attack you in such force that the archers take flight back to Aup, and there's nothing in the meat store where once there were many quarters of meat. Keeping in mind that these songs are slightly later from the period before Petran's departure from Naples with Charles d'Anjou, and Blacat's death in the late 1230s, plus the fact that the second period of Malaspina production in Guatemala, this golden age of troubadour production, lasted a mere 8 years, we can conclude that a troubadour public for at least the first half of the 13th century was by definition a volatile affair, as destructive in its drunkenness and ecstasy, and I'm citing Michel Serre here, as it is in its loyalty and beholdenness. Power can flip quite easily within a collective, but it has lost sight of its target, amour, song, reputation, or some equally intangible gift. The troubadours observed this dynamic at close range in the border zones of Provence and the Malaspina courts, and they left for us first-hand observations, a nascent primer in medieval sociology. Thank you.